Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Thank you, Eunice. Well, I bet you're sitting there thinking, yep, there's a reason why I've never read Zephaniah. I don't tend to enjoy Sunday mornings thinking about my entrails being poured out like dung. It's a very, very powerful and striking passage. And it feels full of darkness and anger. And it's hard to know whether there's a place for this in today's world. We live in a world that seems to have enough anger of its own. Last weekend, of course, we saw a great outpouring of anger in our own city as protesters clashed with police, and we saw scenes of violence like we haven't seen for a long time on our shores. But we live in a world where anger boils up all the time. Anger against uncertainty, loss of control, anger fueled by loss or pain, abuse, fear, threat, violence, anger at injustice, both perceived and actual. We saw over the last few years incredible scenes of anger over the Black Lives Matter movement. And of course, we see great anger about the state of our world, our environment, and our climate, crystallized so powerfully by Greta Thunberg's "How Dare You" speech. We live in an angry world. Not all of us express our anger through violence. Not all of us express our anger even through words. Some of us turn our anger inwards. Some of us turn our anger toward God. And our anger is sometimes very justified. But sometimes our anger is, like the book of James says, not producing the righteousness that God desires. That's James 1, verse 20. And so I wondered to myself, in this angry world, and of course I haven't even spoken about our anger concerning Afghanistan, I wondered, is there a place for the anger of God to minister into the anger of our world? Now, I would usually want to speak about the peace of God, the love of God. To counter the anger in our world, the anger that's come from feeling helpless and hopeless, out of control, the anger that comes from selfishness, the anger that comes from feeling like our desires are thwarted at every turn, I would want to counter this with the love of God, the justice of God, the peace of God, the righteousness of God. And yet instead we have this chapter from the book of Zephaniah. And so for weeks I've been pondering, what does the God who speaks of himself as jealous, as a mighty warrior against the earth. What does this have to say to our angry world? Now, we see a number of responses already as the church and as Christians have taken on this teaching of the anger of God. And perhaps you're aware of a group called the Westboro Baptist Church in the US, and they're very happy to get out there and show signs saying God hates you, God is angry at, insert sin here. Or perhaps people have grown up in religion that has told them that God is an angry and wrathful God, full of guilt. And so they've rejected that religion. Can this picture of an angry God speak to the anger of our world without bringing further anger? Or indeed without turning people away from him? I think it can, and I want to tell you why. First of all, we see here that God is a God of the whole earth. Our anger so often is coming from our own perspective. And yet here we see a God who is able to understand the entirety of the human condition and of human experience, everything that happens on the earth. I will sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away both man and beast. I will sweep away the birds in the sky, the fish in the sea, and the idols that cause the wicked to stumble when I destroy all mankind on the face of the earth, declares the Lord. How do I know that God is a God of global perspective when I read these words? Well, they are words that take me back to two parts of the Old Testament book of Genesis. First of all, they take me back to the time of Noah. Do you remember Noah's flood? Well, God's flood. Noah had the ark. At that time, God said, I'll destroy all mankind from the face of the earth. This was a judgment on everything that was happening. God could see all things, the hearts of all people. But secondly, you can see that this is taking us right back to the time of creation. The language, birds in the sky, fish in the sea, man and beast. Here is a picture of a God who can see all because he made all. And at the end of the chapter, in the fire of his jealousy, the whole earth will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live on the earth. Now, you may think, well, that is not comforting at all, Megan. Not at all. Doesn't speak to my concern with the anger of the world. Well, I want to talk to you about anger. Psychologists know that when we become angry or we feel under threat, something happens in our brain. And particularly to the part of our brain that is able to think clearly, rationally, understand other people's perspective, look at things from a universal perspective, and see into all the other opinions. What happens is when we feel under threat, when we feel angry, a psychologist used the term flooding, our prefrontal cortex is flooded with emotion. We are overwhelmed. And this sense of threat, our kind of fight or flight, when we're really angry, we actually cannot have a reasonable conversation with our spouse, a reasonable conversation with our parent or our child. We cannot understand the world properly. We hop on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever it is, and we just blurt irrational, overwhelmed anger and pain because we cannot anymore see the clarity that there is in the world. We cannot see other people's perspectives. We cannot rationally and reasonably engage with what is wrong. And so human beings must look to a God who sees all. It's not always wrong to be angry, but we need to come to the one who understands all things, who is never overwhelmed, who is never unable to see every part of the story. God, the God who created the whole world, who sees all that happens and can understand every nuance, can see every part of the story, it's to him that we must turn. So I believe that God's universal perspective here, God's power and his global perspective, is an important, first of all, warning, but also encouragement for us when we are angry, when we are overwhelmed, to stop and go to him for clarity. We also see in verse 12 that God's anger never stays in the dark. So God here is speaking of the time when his judgment will come. And he says, at that time, I will search Jerusalem with lamps. It's a picture, if you will, of that old-fashioned watchman with their lamp going about the city, which doesn't have electric lights, looking into every corner to decide whether he can say 12 o'clock and all's well. But no, with this lamp, the watchman who goes through the city will see that what has been hidden in darkness is now coming to light, and it is off. It is corrupt. There is sinfulness and brokenness hiding in the darkness. God not only has a global perspective, but also he has a clarity. But let's see what it is that God is angry about. Well, I wonder if you can tell me, Phil, you can put up the picture of the movies, if you will. I wonder if you can tell me what these movies all have in common. Phil thought maybe it was that they all had a hero. That is true, but not what I'm looking for here. I'll tell you the movies. Yeah, white male protagonist. Thank you very much, Eunice. I could go down that role, but that's not road, but that's not where I'm going today. We've got The Hobbit. We got Casino Royale. We have Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And someone's going to have to help me with which Star Wars this is, what it's called. Episode 3 anyway. What these movies all have in common is they're all prequels. I bet you didn't know Temple of Doom was a prequel, but apparently it is. It's set before Raiders of the Lost Ark. These are the things, important things that you learn when you're researching Bible sermons. Fascinating. That's probably going to stay with you more than the book of Zephaniah. Very concerning. Thank you, Revenge of the Sith. So these prequels are actually like the book of Zephaniah, longbow, but it was worth it, to the book of Daniel. Do you remember the book of Daniel? I hope you do, because we spent a good 13 weeks on it earlier in the year. The book of Daniel takes place after the exile or the Babylonian conquest and captivity of the southern kingdom of Judah. And the book of Zephaniah is a prequel to that. We are now years earlier, and Babylon has not come against Judah at this time. In fact, Assyria is the superpower, and there is a king called Josiah. We saw at the start of chapter 1 of Zephaniah, the word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, during the reign of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. In this introduction, two great kings are mentioned, and they were the two bright hopes for the southern kingdom of Judah. That is, there was a whole, Israel was a whole, and the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom split up. They had two different kings rather than just one ruling the lot. The top kingdom, the northern kingdom, was attacked and was taken off by Assyria. The southern kingdom remained intact and independent and was in the middle of a bunch of power struggles between Assyria, Egypt, and some other nations who were deciding to whom they would give allegiance. In the midst of that, Hezekiah and then his great-grandson, Josiah, maybe great-great, were two kings who sought the Lord. And for the people of Judah, this was their moment to turn back to God. Zephaniah was also a descendant of Hezekiah. And so he and the king at the time, Josiah, were cousins, and they were young men. And Zephaniah is speaking into this moment where it's like the southern kingdom is on the precipice of whether they go into that time of captivity in Babylon, which we read all about in Daniel, or whether they're going to maintain an adherence and an allegiance to the Lord, whether they will turn back to the Lord and hear his guidance to the point of being able to resist when the enemy comes. And Josiah is working hard, and we'll hear more about that next week, to help the people of Judah to turn back. And so we've got this story happening. And if you'd seen the movies, you know, like if Daniel had been Star Wars 1, 2, and 3, which then became 4, 5, and 6, you know, you'd be like, okay, this is okay. I understand. I have a bad feeling about this, though. I've seen the future. I know which way they go. And they go into captivity. But just for this moment, you think, could it go differently? Did God set them up to take a fall, or did he warn them? Was he so angry that he would just allow them and send his people to go into captivity without giving them a chance? Well, you don't know when you're reading the book of Daniel, maybe. But then we see this prequel, episode 3 or 2 or 1 or 0 or minus 1 or, you know, whatever it is you can watch now. And you do see a warning. You see that God has made it really clear what he is angry about and what the punishment that is coming is really for. Now, this helps us with our anger too, because it shows us what God is really angry about. Now, I'm angry about all kinds of things, right? I'm particularly angry that I'm not going to be able to go to Queensland, right? You know, and I'm sure many of you are like, yep, yep, got that one. I'm disappointed. I'm not an angry sort of person. I just turn it in on myself. But we need to know what makes righteous anger and what makes unrighteous anger that does not bring about the life that God desires. And so we look here at a God who is so wrathful, not about human mistakes, not about our imperfection, not about things that are just understandable, and isn't God just so unreasonable? We see here that God is angry about, number one, complacency, number two, idolatry, and number three, injustice. And he's speaking to his people. Very easy for the church today to be angry with the world. But God's anger here today is speaking to the people of God. So complacency, and there's an amazing, amazing image here. And we'll go down to verse 12 again. It really is the kind of key verse of this whole chapter. At that time, I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish those who are complacent, who are like wine left on its dregs, who think the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. Now, if you have listened to any of my sermons, you know, you know more about me than you wish you did. And you know that I'm not a wine drinker. However, I, again, just like I learned about Raiders of the Lost Ark, etc., I did do some research about what this means, wine left on its dregs. Well, you know that when you're making wine, you're making it out of crushed up grapes, and there is a sediment that forms in the wine. And so, you know, it would be horrendous if you had a really old bottle of wine and you like shook it up to pour it. You know, that's why you would decant a wine sometimes too, to make sure none of the sediment gets in, and all of that. So here we have a picture of people who were supposed to know God, and yet somehow are now like wine left on its dregs. That is, that all that's left in the bottle of their relationship with God is just the awful dregs, the sediment at the bottom, the stuff that's no good. And they don't care. They've let their hearts and their life with God just get drained down to the dregs, and they sit there and think that it's okay to live their faith out of those dregs. They've not filled it up. They've not done anything that would enable their hearts to be filled with good, lively wine. But instead, they're just resting on their dregs. That is, the stuff that we knew years ago, the experiences that we had, the disappointments that we felt, the loss, the selfishness. It's just sitting there and we're not going to do anything about it. And what comes out of living on your dregs, you end up thinking the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. You don't pray because you think you know the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. You don't try and strive for holiness, even though it's always hard, because you just think, oh, well, the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. I won't be judged. I won't be rewarded. God won't bring a miracle. He won't hear my prayers. He doesn't care if I ask or not. The Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. Verse 6 brings us into even sharper application. Those who turn back from following the Lord and neither seek the Lord nor inquire of him. The people of Israel had had so much in their lives and in their history that was rich and good, like an amazing wine, that would help them to know that God was abundant and good and rich and worth following. That when you had to wait, you knew that something great was going to come. When you had to say no to things because of the law of God, you knew that it was because something great and rich was going to come. But God says, you've become complacent. You neither seek the Lord nor inquire of him, and you think the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. Part of what makes human anger so strong at the moment is the sense of uncertainty and a sense of helplessness. I said before, I'm not a really angry person, but when I feel helpless, that's where it really comes out in my heart. We feel helpless against so many things. Not only lockdowns, not only the pandemic, but the great injustice around the world. What's happening with our kids? We feel helpless. And so anger rises. But it won't rise unrighteously if we reject the idea that the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. If you live in that complacency, even as a Christian, if you live on your dregs like, yeah, oh, yeah, I used to believe it. If you neither seek the Lord nor inquire of him, yes, you are going to feel really helpless. But God's anger against that shows us that our anger can be dealt with when we come to a God who will act. The book of Zephaniah uses the term the day of the Lord very strongly, significantly, and repetitively. You see the word day throughout this first chapter, but also the day of the Lord at the beginning and at the end and then throughout. He uses it not only for bad, but also for good. But here at the beginning, the day of the Lord, as it is throughout all of Scripture, is that defining moment when God will come and there will be an undeniable action in history by God to bring justice and salvation. You've seen in the New Testament that when the Holy Spirit was given at Pentecost, Peter used words from the book of Joel and said, this is what God promised on the great and dreadful day of the Lord, that the Holy Spirit would be poured out before the great and dreadful day of the Lord came. We are living in a time where God does intervene in history, but he will also do so decisively at the end of time. Here in Zephaniah, the day of the Lord was twofold. There would come a time when the people of Judah and Jerusalem would indeed be swept away, where this picture of the flood of Noah's time would be a great description of the incredible power of Babylon coming in to destroy Jerusalem. But not only did this take place in history, the day of the Lord becomes that promise that God will do something both good and bad from our perspective, that he will make an end to all idolatry and injustice. So these are the second and third things that God is angry about in this passage. Idolatry. You can see that throughout the passage. I'll stretch out my hand against Judah and against all who live in Jerusalem. I'll destroy every remnant of Baal worship in this place. The very names of the idolatrous priests, those who bow down on the roofs to worship the starry hosts, those who bow down and swear by the Lord and who also swear by Molech. Here we've got two of the so-called gods of the surrounding nations being worshipped by God's people, Baal and Molech. Baal worship was associated with a bunch of sexual immorality, and Molech worship actually included child sacrifice. These are not only abhorrent in terms of idolatrous dilution of worship of the one true God, but they're actually just abhorrent practices against God's creation. God says, idolatry will not be allowed to last. It wasn't allowed to last in Jerusalem and Judah. They were wiped out. But also when I see these words, who bow down and swear by the Lord, this is verse 5, and who also swear by Molech, I'm brought up short. It's possible, God says, to claim the name of the Lord, but also to share that worship that's due only to him with other things. It's possible to say that you worship God alone and yet give your allegiance to, well, perhaps another God. Perhaps money, perhaps career, perhaps romance, perhaps beauty, perhaps safety, perhaps security. And this mixed worship brings God's anger. But thirdly, and as I said, those that idolatry brought practices of injustice, ethical, or unethical practices, God is angry at injustice. You see, those in verse 9, those who fill the temple of their gods with violence and deceit. And then wail in verse 11, you who live in the market district, all your merchants will be wiped out. All who trade with silver will be destroyed. Down in verse 18, neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of the Lord's wrath. God is looking at a people who are supposed to be consecrated to him. but instead who are bringing violence, deceit, potentially child sacrifice, and abuse of power through the misuse of wealth. And he says, I will put an end to it. So as we come to a close, how does God's anger help us deal with our anger in this angry world? First of all, it calls us to come to him with our anger, because only God has a global perspective. Only God can understand every side of the story. You remember in the book of Daniel, God's called the revealer of mysteries. So much of human life is a mystery to you and I, even when we feel so smart. Only God understands every facet of what is going on in every circumstance. And so he calls us to come to him to see what we ought to be angry about or not. Second of all, we come to the God who shows us that he will do something about what makes us angry. We feel helpless. It seems like there's no end in sight. But God says, I will bring a day. The great day of the Lord is near and coming quickly. The mighty warrior shouts his battle cry. God will make an end of complacency, idolatry, and injustice. God will do it. It is his promise. He's done it before, and he will do it again. And so the feelings of helplessness and hopelessness that you and I might have that stir up that anger within us, that make us want to do something, anything to express it. Come to the promises of God that he will deal with it. Get his perspective and his promise. But thirdly, you need to know that you could be in the group that God is saying, I'm angry. So much of the time when we feel angry, we feel we're on the side of the right and others are on the side of the wrong. But God is saying to us here, look at your own life. Judgment will come on you, including in the church, just as much as it may come on another. And he says, I will sweep away and then I will burn. I will clear everything out and then I will destroy it. And it's a wonderful promise, except that there is nobody righteous, not even one. No one escapes except. When a wildfire is moving through perhaps a forest or a plain, a grassland, where is the safest place to be? Well, friends, it's actually to be in the place where that fire has already burned. We're about to celebrate Holy Communion, and this is that place. The day of the Lord came upon Jesus Christ on the cross so that it did not have to come on you and I in judgment if we are to stand with him. The fire of God, the sweeping away of all evil, the judgment of God on complacency, idolatry, and injustice all fell on him. And we can either stand in that place where the fire has already burned, or we can decide to face it ourselves. When we come to the Lord's Supper, when we take the bread and the wine, this is actually what we're doing. We're placing ourselves behind the one, or in the one, upon whom the judgment of God has already burned, so that the day of the Lord may not be a day of wrath for us, but a day of salvation. Next week, we're going to see that it is possible to be called back to Yahweh, to turn to him, to find that hope of salvation. But we can't today, of course, leave our story on the anger of God without God's being able to avert that anger from us. The safest place in this angry world is to be with the one upon whom God's anger has already burned and is gone.